ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
This Week in Cinemas, Rose Byrne plays a mother caring for a child with a peculiar chronic digestive disorder. The girl, whose face we never see in the movie, is attached to a machine that constantly buzzes and whirs as it delivers her body sustenance via a tube. The movie is one with a very strange title. In fact, I think it would vie for the prize of weirdest title of the year. If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You. Hello, I'm Jason DeRosso. This is The Screen Show on ABC Radio National. If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You is the focus of the first part of the show this week. It's part horror film, part black comedy, and also partly a very serious drama about motherhood. If you wanted an actor able to navigate all of those registers, I reckon Rose Byrne would be your woman. She won the Best Actor at Berlin for this performance. It's an intense ride, a portrait of permanent parental panic as Byrne's character, Linda, struggles to cope while her husband's away for work and she has to look after their daughter at night by herself while working during the day as a therapist of all things. To add insult to injury, the family home gets flooded and Linda has to move herself, her daughter, and the machine to a motel, where there they all endure even more sleep deprivation. And Linda befriends a young night manager, played by the rapper ASAP Rocky, who helps her self-medicate to try and decompress from the stress of it all. If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You is an unsettling, nightmarish vision, but it's also about a woman's resilience and resourcefulness, and in that sense, it's a bracing tribute. I caught up with writer-director Mary Bronstein earlier in the year when she presented the film, her second feature, in competition at the Melbourne International Film Festival. She's coming up after this clip.
You've missed the last few weeks of family sessions.
I told you what happened. Our entire ceiling fell down and we're living out of the hotel.
Yes on these, but no on the wine.
But it isn't even 2.
It's 1:58. By the time I ring these up, it will be past 2.
Yo, crazy pants. I was gonna partake in surfing the web for some things that I'm into.
What kind of stuff? I'm supposed to know how to fix this. I'm supposed to know how to fix her.
What is it you think it's your job to fix?
I'm asking you what I'm supposed to do. Can you hear me?
I would like you to get a good night's sleep.
Whatever. This isn't supposed to be what it's like. This isn't it. This can't be it.
Everything is under control.
Mary Bronstein, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be talking to you.
Well, I'm really happy to be talking to you because this is such an extraordinary film and I really want to ask you about how you made it, why you made it, of course. I mean, it's a harrowing film. You know, what I like about it is that I don't think it's a film that you could make unless you're well into that middle stage of your life because it really captures the juggling so well.
Oh, thank you. Yes, absolutely. I agree. I am 45 years old. I'm officially middle-aged if I live to be 90, I guess. But, you know, my first film that I made was really about like the transition between being a young adult in college to being an adult in the real world and how difficult that can be. I wanted to make a movie that, as you said, really represents the struggles, the existential crises that can happen, and the sort of overwhelmingness of life when we get to middle age, especially if we have responsibilities that are in conflict with each other, which I believe is most of us. By that, I mean work, family, children, and then your own mental health and your own identity. And that's really what I wanted to explore. And my main thing was to present something to the viewer that hopefully they had never seen before and never taken the time to think about before.
Tell me about the decision or the decisions behind the way you shot this film.
Yes, there's so many decisions. So every decision that you see visually in the film existed at the script level. I was writing the script as a not knowing if how, when it would ever get made. But I was writing it as a pure howling into the wind self-expression that I needed to put on paper. And I knew
this is because you, I mean, this story reflects in some way your own experience as a mother of an ill child.
Yes, I went through an experience. My daughter is 15 now and very well and healthy and happy. But when she was 7 years old, she became quite ill. What I always like to say, though, and this is through a conversation I had with my daughter, is that her experience, what she went through, that's a story for her to tell one day if she ever wants to. That's very important to understanding this movie at a very DNA level, because on a script level, I wanted to concentrate on the mother's experience in this kind of situation. As soon as a viewer sees a child, your sympathy is going to go to that child, because that is how we are wired as human beings. And that is correct and right. We don't often see movies that are purely from the mother's point of view, where we're saying she has a child. This is not about the child. This is about the mother. And mothers are not given that space in real life. And I wanted to give that space on screen. As far as the visual choices that you're talking about, where we don't see the child and we're so in Linda's point of view, we never see anything that she doesn't see. We're never in a room where she's not in. We don't hear conversations that she's not a part of. I wanted to really, if I could have gotten like behind her eyeballs, that's where I want to be. So on a script level, I made all of those decisions. And the script I started writing in the midst of the illness that my daughter was experiencing. The two of us had to go across country for a treatment. We were weird, demented roommates in this cheap motel with a tiny room. And the only way that I could find space for myself was at night after my daughter would go to sleep at like 8 o'clock. She was little, totally dark in the room. And I would go into the bathroom and turn the light on, horrible hotel bathroom overhead light. And I would sit on the bathroom floor and literally kind of feel myself disappearing. Because when you're so present in caretaking, there's no room for you to exist. And I would start thinking about, well, what happens after? What happens after she gets better? Like, who am I? What am I going to do? What is life going to be like? It was a real, I would call it a real existential crisis. There was an immediacy into me needing to put it on paper while I was experiencing it. Then, of course, later I go back and refine it as a film. But what I hope is that for the viewer, what I was trying to capture on set was that immediacy of that feeling of, I must express this right now. And that's the intensity that I hope the viewer experiences when they watch the film.
Oh, I think they will. Absolutely. I mean, it's certainly something I experienced. It's a very visceral experience watching this film.
Visceral is a good word.
And hearing it as well. Because, I mean, it's such a subjective soundscape that you create that helps us enter into the emotions of all of this. And the stresses, especially, including the sort of drips and gurgles of the machinery that keeps your daughter alive at night.
Yeah. Yes.
Your daughter's voice, of course, which we hear a lot.
Yes. That's very, very, very.
Well, your character's daughter. Sorry, the character's daughter's
voice. It's okay.
Voice,
I would get mixed up all the time too. So would Rose. but Rose really. One of our first conversations was I said, "This is sort of like you're my emotional avatar, right?" So I wrote the script, like you said, very visceral, very emotional, very personal. But now somebody else, I'm going to watch it from the outside. How trippy is that, right? And I'm also going to direct it. And I'm also going to be in charge of when this woman is suffering, when she has a moment of relief. and the pile on that the universe of the movie does to her, right? And so it was very sort of a meta experience for me. But the daughter is played by a very, very, very talented actress named Delaney Quinn. You don't see her. She is there. I required her to be on set at all times when they have a scene together so that Rose in the film is never acting against nothing. She is actually performing a scene with a child. Whenever she's on the phone, the actor is on the other end of the phone. That is how I shot the film. And I felt like that was very important, not only as a respect for Rose as a performer, but also as a filmmaker. I wanted the film to feel as practical and real as possible in those moments, so that when I was getting into, like you're talking about, the expressive choices I'm making with the soundscape, something can be so real and then something can feel so not real. And how those things are going together was very interesting to me as a filmmaker to explore.
I'm interested in also definitely tipping a hat to the comic dimension of this film. So there is that. And you know, clearly Rose Byrne, I mean, we just on my show in recent weeks, we've spoken about Platonic. I spoke to the husband and wife showrunners on that show that she stars opposite Seth Rogen in. So she's so a great comic. That. Yeah.
Oh, she's gifted. Gifted comedian, also naturally funny person, gifted with timing. And it was part of my decision of casting as well. Because here in Australia, she's, you know, beloved. In the States, she is so beloved that whenever I would mention this, who's playing Rose Byrne? Oh, I love Rose Byrne. That's everybody's reaction when you say her name. And I knew that I was going to push the viewer, take the viewer, ask the viewer to go with me so far in a direction that's going to be uncomfortable, going to be dark, going to be difficult, that I wanted the immediate first look of the face of this film, and the film is her face, and her face is the film, to be a face that you just, even if subconsciously, you have a kindness towards or a warm feeling towards. Right. Even if, like I say, it's not conscious. Well, I like her.
Yeah. Especially in a film where the character's potentially really challenging that initial sympathy that you have.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because there's the whole notion of this good parenting or bad parenting at a certain point. I mean, that's the friction point in the film, really. We start that to go, is she a good parent here or is she a bad parent?
Exactly. And I felt like it was very important to have somebody that had comedic ability and that would, it's like, yeah, I'll go with her on this.
And it makes the table turning more fun too, right? Yes. To experience,
yes, like,
because you're going, she's so sympathetic and charismatic. And now I'm thinking after what I've just seen the character do, maybe I don't like this person or, you know.
I feel about that. Yeah. Okay. Oh, she just did that. Would I ever do that?
Yeah. Well, and as a colleague too, and here's the other thing, Conan O'Brien's in the film and he's very good, and you haven't leaned into the comic dimension of his acting skill at all. It's straight down the line. He's really good though. He's really good as a straight, very serious character.
Oh, his performance I find to be triumphant. I don't even think that's too big of a word.
No, I agree. It's really good.
Because it is something he has never done before, ever. And when I approached him for it, he said to me, I want to do it. The script is amazing. This is exciting. I don't know if I can do this. And I said, well, I think you can. And he was like, okay, but I will do it. But you need to promise me something. I was like, what? He said, if I suck, you can fire me and we'll be friends. It's cool. And I was like, you're not going to suck. And then that became a running joke where he was like, am I fired? Did you, I got Ted Danson on the line. He's ready to come in and replace me. And I was like, no, you were so good. But, he, I think, surprised himself. He surprised everyone that knows him. And I think the viewers are going to find it incredibly exciting.
One final question, 35mm film. What is the attraction?
Well, it was my first opportunity ever in working. You know, I've mainly worked on a sort of like underground cult. I hate the phrase cult classic or whatever. But that sort of like tradition. You know, DIY scrappy. I'm going to make a film with nothing. Sort of tradition. This is the first time that I had resources where I could use film. And a lot of the films that inspired me to want to work in film were made on film. So it was an experience I wanted to have. When you have a film camera, when people hopefully that are listening go see the film, when they see how close up I get to Rose, I'm not using zoom lenses. The camera physically as an object is that close to her. And film is a physical thing and you can hear it. You can hear it whirring in the camera. It's an analog thing. And you can shoot until the film runs out and then you have to stop and then you have to change the film. Film smells a certain way. The camera gets hot in a certain way. And there was something about the graininess of film, of light coming through film that I thought was the most appropriate format for this movie. I'm not a snob. My next movie could be shot on an iPhone. I don't know. But for this film, I needed it to be not slick, not clean, not new. Do you know what I mean by that?
Yeah.
Need to be a little dirty, a little grungy, and.
Well, I know you also you kind of operate in similar circles, artistic and social, and otherwise to the Safdie brothers, and they're big on film as well. And so there seems to be this whole kind of scene around New York, perhaps, where filmmakers are wanting this and going for this quality of celluloid.
I mean, in film school right now, they do not teach on film. They do not teach students in the States anyway. I don't know about here. They don't teach students how to edit splicing film and taping it together and putting it through. That doesn't exist anymore. My husband, Ronald Bronstein, who's a creative partners with Josh Safdie, that is how he's a little older than us. And that is how he learned to do it. And I think once you learn to do it in that way and you know what that is, there's a different kind of filmmaking that you can do, because then it's not about, it's the mother of invention is limitations, right? And I, as an artist, I like to put those on myself. And so one thing I want to say before we wrap up too, is that there's a lot of visual effects in this film. They are 99.9% practical. I only used VFX to clean up and do some necessary things, but all the things that happen in the film that are some other people, some other artists might use computers, is practically done. It is the hard way to go. But for me, it was very, it was what I needed to do. And it was, I think, right for the film, and hopefully it gives the effect that I'm intending.
I think it absolutely does. Mary, congratulations on it.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much.
Filmmaker Mary Bronstein, If I Had Legs, I'd Kick You, is out this week. And if you want further proof that motherhood is a rich source of inspiration for filmmakers, also worth checking out in cinemas is Lynn Ramsey's new one, an impressionistic psychodrama called Die, My Love, starring Jennifer Lawrence, Robert Pattinson and Sissy Spacek. Great cast. A film about a young mother spiraling out of control in a remote rural property, beautifully shot. You're listening to The Screen Show, brought to you by ABC Radio National. I'm Jason DeRosso. Now to a series on Apple TV, an espionage thriller called The Last Frontier, created by the showrunner John Bokenkamp and starring my next guests, Australian Jason Clarke and New Zealander Simon Kessel. They play an Alaskan husband and wife, Frank and Sarah Remnick. He's a US Marshal, she's a nurse, and they're just emerging from the emotional turmoil of a devastating loss when an emergency at Frank's work threatens to unsettle their lives again. A plane that's carrying a group of dangerous, violent convicts has crash-landed in the nearby wilderness, and he ends up leading the manhunt to round them all up. And they include a mysterious terrorist known as Havelock, played by Dominic Cooper. Now, Havelock at some point seems to have been a CIA operative, and he holds a fascination for Frank and his wife. He communicates with them while he's on the run. Communicates in a rather sinister way, as super spies on the run who may or may not have gone over to the dark side tend to do. From the opening airplane crash sequence of the series, this is a show that has a splashy action movie feel with some intricate high-speed land and air chases throughout the snowbound, high-altitude terrain, basically peppering the whole series. It's interesting to see one of the series directors is a former Marvel stunt coordinator. It figures. Meanwhile, the show has a multi-strand plot that teases the audience with several mysteries at once. Nothing is what it seems. I guess you expect that. And that includes Frank and Sarah. Who are they as people? What exactly happened to them as a couple? They, as characters, are both grounded by some convincing emotional realism from my next guests, Clark and Kessel. They're both great in these roles. You'll know Simone Kessel from her role as Lottie in Yellowjackets, the adult Lottie, while Jason Clarke has been in films like Oppenheimer, Zero Dark Thirty, and The Great Gatsby. And at the moment, you can see him in Catherine Bigelow's latest film about a nuclear confrontation, A House of Dynamite. And he's also the lead in a true crime miniseries, Murder, Death in the Family. But he was in the ABC studios to talk about The Last Frontier. And he and Simon are coming up after this clip.
All right, everyone, circle up. We have a down plane 2 miles south from here. It is used to move inmates around the country.
11 are captured, 18 still missing.
This is going to be their one shot at freedom.
Mr. Remnick, Sydney Schofield.
CIA. Havelock's out there executing a plan. Do whatever it takes to secure the perimeter.
Knock, knock!
Schofield, this is Alaska. There is no perimeter. People up here are different.
Morning, Frank!
And I took an oath to protect them.
This will consume you. I can see it. I've seen what this man is capable of.
See what's going on. I'm looking for 18 prisoners. And the CIA is looking for one.
Clock is ticking.
Simon and Jason, welcome to the Screen Show.
Thank you.
This must have been a really attractive project, I imagine, because on the one hand, it's this action film, action series that borrows a lot from action films. I think they're quite spectacular set pieces in it. It's a thriller, but it's also this marital drama, essentially, as well. So are you sort of using all of the weapons in your arsenals?
Yeah, there are a few weapons after 20 years of marriage, but also I've known Jason for, let's say, 25 years. That feels safe. Since we were young actors in Sydney, actually, both in and out of work. I hit the out more. And doing theatre and finding our ways. I mean, Jason's originally from Adelaide. I'm from New Zealand. So we were definitely sort of young thespians finding our way in Sydney. And I think every time we're on screen and we work together, it's just a celebration. I mean, The Last Frontier has brought us together, and that familiarity, I think, brings a strength to the screen. Jason?
Yeah, who's afraid of Virginia Woolf? No, but it's true. It was an exciting project. You know, it's, you know, I love that John, you know, had a history of writing a long-running series with twists and turns and narrative. It's a wonderful river narrative. You know, it takes pressure off a certain amount of acting. I wasn't sitting there thinking, oh my God, I got to make this work. You know, the story is a lot, doing a lot of the work for you. And then there's the action on top of that. And then there's, you know, what Simon and I brought together. And I think that's one of the great surprises of it. It starts off and it moves in directions you're not really sure of, right to the very last episode. And it does become a marital drama. And it was the first time we've ever worked together on screen. And it was, we were there in Montreal on the other side of the world, creating, you know, this story together. And it was fantastic to have someone there to do it with me.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say you hadn't crossed paths much in LA or wherever.
No, I literally remember they sent me the top two choices. They said, "We've made our choice, Jason. We're just going to show you." And I remember going, "Oh my God, it's Kessie!" You know, I screamed out to my wife.
And you called and you were like, "Why didn't you tell me you'd auditioned?" And
I said, "Because
I wanted to get it on my own merit." I was just like, if I'm right for it, because I think I'm at that place now. If you're right for the role, fantastic. If you're not, you know, don't try any harder. Yeah. And so I was like, I'm going to put down a really great screen test. And if it lands in front of Jason, great. If it doesn't, so be it. And then he called me straight away and he was like, "Oh my God, I just saw you." And, you know, and then it sort of fell into place from there.
Something I've read about both of you is that you're actors who like to prepare to an almost forensic detail. Was that the case on this? Did you find you needed to prepare a lot, given that it's in a very specific regional location? There's a lot of specificity to this community in which it's set.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very interesting question, Jason. And it's like, you've also got to prepare, just to reframe that, you've also got to prepare for, like, it's an 8-month shoot. I've got a family. I'm on the other side of the world. There's a lot of action, being physically ready to do it, you know, getting all the pieces together so that when the train leaves the station and doesn't stop for 8 months, you know, I'm going to be okay and I'm not going to let the team down and I'm going to support and help out and try and throw it down, you know, so the series works. So every job has different levels of what is required to get ready. And this one straight away, you know, we're shooting in snow over, you know, the set over like, you know, 10 or 11 days, this whole series. And we're shooting over 6-7 months. So there's not snow for that long. So you knew we were going to be shooting insanely out of order. So I broke down my scripts in a way that I would never normally do. I knew the outside scenes were going to be shot first. And to make sure that all my ducks were in a row so that when I'm shooting, you know, in one day, you might be shooting, you know, scene episode 1, 4, 7, and then back to 2, because you're getting these scenes required. So there was a different way of preparing, as well as the action, as well as, you know, dialect. I had to make sure that I was physically ready to do these action sequences, you know, on my body at my age and maintaining that for a long period of time, because you can't just, you know, hit the gate hard and have nothing for the next, you know, the next period. Yeah.
There's a lot of action in this, actually. And obviously there are stunt doubles a lot of the time, I imagine, but it's clear that you're also doing your own stunts at other points. How much do you have to train for a physical shoot like this?
I think you warm up into it, and we had a few rehearsals, a lot more. I mean, Jason does a lot of stunts in this, and they're fantastic. I know you're holding your knee now because you heard it in one of the big action sequences.
It's a memory.
Look, that's how well I know him. We are like, right. Like I'm like, that's from that scene. But also, yes, you've got to be just physically fit. You've got to be on it. You've got to conserve your energy. And also because it's so cold, the elements, you know, minus 25, we're not used to that. And so I was always like staying strong, staying fit, working in a dialect as well, just always changing your physicality, your voice, your stance. So
what is the dialect like up there? Is it like Sarah Palin, right? She's an Alaskan.
We could have gone there. We chose not to.
Okay.
We made it more neutral because the characters are originally from Chicago and then everywhere else. So it didn't have to be specific. They had landed there. That was their backstory.
It's a general West Coast accent. Yeah. It's a general American. You call general American. Then you have Central American. Then you have Southern American. Then you have East Coast. It's more of a West Coast accent.
Tell me about the themes of this show, because on the surface it begins, well, operating on a couple of levels. On the one level, it's this family drama and that focuses in on this marriage that's undergone this devastating loss, but we won't give that away. And so this couple are in the aftermath of that, and then they're dragged back into this crisis thanks to your character's work as a US Marshal. He has to hunt down these escaped convicts, and one in particular who seems to be this very ambiguous, typical of an espionage thriller, really, an ambiguous kind of dangerous figure. But it strikes me that one of the themes here is about the ends justifying the means, which is, you know, what spies are often about. They don't care who they double cross and whatever. But that theme comes home to roost, really, for your two characters in your marriage too, right?
Well, I mean, you know, it's one of those themes in law enforcement as well, you know, I mean, and you often... You know, it's one of the great questions, isn't it? You know, do the ends justify the means, and what ends? You know, in our particular marriage, it's beautiful because somebody else has paid the price for something that my character Frank has done, you know, and my family has. And you, when you realize what he's actually, what he did and why he did it, and his, you know, his inability to reconcile with that, I guess, and his inability to come clean with his family about it, you know, the burden's gone on to his wife and his son.
Because it's a show where initially the danger and the problem to be solved is external.
Yeah.
But then
the internal.
It creeps
the
into something else.
It creeps into it.
That's what John does so well. You know, it starts off as a, you know, episodic.
That's John Bockenkamp who wrote the series.
An episodic thriller. You know, each episode is a new monster, a new bad guy. You know, there is that Con Air element to it, and then it slips into, you know, there was even for me, you know, an element of No Country for Old Men, this wave of darkness coming over the border. And then, you know, it goes right into the end. Sydney's character plays out or mirrors what's going on between Sarah and I and our son.
It's also a show reckoning, obviously, with the way that America deals with its foreign policy and the way that it recruits spies and uses its influence overseas and so forth. Do you think it's a timely kind of story?
You know, that's a means justify the ends kind of question in a way, you know, the chicken or the egg. I mean, yes, it is there, the reach, you know, of the CIA in its own country, the overreach. It's, you know, it's entertainment in a straight up way. And I think things just speak to us as well because, you know, we're in an echo chamber of reverberation. And so, of course, there's a lot that comes in there, you know. That's why I say the element of No Country for Old Men. There's hints of it all in there tied up in a great narrative journey. But, you know, yeah, America's at the forefront of a lot of things in the world because it is the biggest country around.
I mean, I think of you and the wonderful performance in Zero Dark Thirty and think back to that time, and we were thinking things were pretty dark and complex and nothing was what it seemed back then. Are you surprised that, you know, the country you're living in a lot of the time and working in, how things have developed in recent years with the two presidencies that
we've
had?
I guess so, but, you know, I also did a film called Chappaquiddick, you know, and part of my research for Chappaquiddick was 1968. Yeah, Chappaquiddick happened in 69, but 68 was, yeah, I mean,
it was about,
you know,
the Kennedy
Martin
family
Luther King and they were assassinated. And I also just finished a podcast on the Battle of Trafalgar and Horatio Nelson. And you realize that, you know, England was facing, you know, invasion, but there are traumatic, crazy times all the time, you know. And I think it's always humanity's and people's lot in life to try and solve those problems and to work through them and to make the world a better place and to leave a legacy and to, you know, to give more than we get. And it's no different in our time than it was in 68 or, you know, in 69 with Vietnam and in terms of, you know, going further back. We've always had these insane problems to tackle and everyone's got a job. And I think Catherine in, say, House of Dynamite, you know, does an extraordinary job for art for that, just hands you this issue of, like, we have the power to destroy ourselves in our hands, not just with the nuclear bomb, but with the coming AI, you know, and how do we deal with that as a race? And so I think, if you study history, times have always been like this. There's always been cycles and there's always been difficulties and we've always been, our great strength as humans is problem solvers.
What about in the case of women, though? I'm just wondering, Simone, I think opportunities have changed for women in recent decades in society more generally. And how do you find that film and television has reflected that in the roles that you're offered or that you're attracted by?
That's a great question because it has been a game changer for me as mixed race. And I feel that, you know, when we were kicking around Sydney 25 years ago, there weren't those roles for me. They just weren't written or they weren't seen or I had to be a specific nationality to play those roles. Now we're seen, and now because the world is changing, I mean, that's what I love about Sydney. It's such a melting pot. You know, you've got so much diversity here. We are now seeing that on our screens and we're not even questioning it. And it's refreshing for me because I've been at this for a long time. And now it's because of the ever-changing world that we live in, these roles are being written. And so, yeah, it's kind of double-edged sword, really.
I always find America seems to be a bit more ahead of the game than Australia when it comes to diversity, though, and kind of colorblind casting and just casting people because the look and the chemistry is right, not really questioning too much into why does that person look like that, or what, you know, not playing the backstory up too much.
Yeah, well, especially in New Zealand. I mean, that's why when I left New Zealand, I was just getting pigeonholed into playing Marty. And I was like, but I want to play the lawyer. Or the, you know, like, no, you're the single mum living in a state house. And I'm like, well, truly. And now those times have gone. So that's a wonderful thing, you know. Like, now I do get to play the judge. Slightly older, I play the judge rather than the lawyer. And now I'm an admiral. So, you know, yeah, they are changing, especially for women, especially for women. And that's what I, you know, going back to The Last Frontier, we're in Alaska. They're the native people there, even though we didn't film it in Alaska, that's still represented on our screens. And that's interesting. And it's not talked about, it just is, as it should be.
Yeah, tell me about the sense of community in this show, because I think it's really strong. And I know that you grew up in a small town, didn't you, Jason, in Queensland, or you were born in Winton.
Yeah.
What is it saying about community? Because your character, Frank, who is this, you know, lawmaker, he is thrust into a kind of professional partnership with a woman, and that's perhaps a bit of a challenge for him. But he has very strong ideas about what this community is and how communities like this work.
Well, he's gone home to his community after their personal tragedy and after everything that's gone on with them. They've gone home to seek that shelter, to reacquaint, to, I mean, you know, it's community's everything, isn't it, at the end of the day? And I think the show represents that. It's your, you know, in the wilderness and, you know, in the extremities of nature, like you are up there, that you rely on your neighbor, even if they're 20 kilometers away or 20 miles away in this instance.
But it's not often shown a lot on our screens. The man who will go out and throw a punch, take down a baddie and go home and have, you know, a sandwich at home with his wife, you know, and then root for his community and be there. Like, it's a very American word. I'm so American suddenly, and there's a root for his community. But Jason, I just have to say, you do it so beautifully, and that's the heart of the show.
Actors Simon Kessel and Jason Clarke, who both star in and truly elevate the show The Last Frontier, a spy series over on Apple TV. You're listening to ABC Radio National's The Screen Show with me, Jason DeRosso. In the new film from my final guest this week, Ukrainian Sergei Loznitsa, there's a sense of terrible inevitability. The film is called Two Prosecutors. It's set in 1937 during Stalin's ruthless and bloody purges. And it's adapted from a book that was banned for decades by Georgi Demidov, who himself spent years in the Gulag. It's the story of a young public prosecutor who comes to a remote jail to investigate the providence of a small note written in blood by an inmate. After some strategic stalling from the prison warden, the young man is led to a filthy cell where a staunch elderly Bolshevik claims he's been wrongly imprisoned and tortured. The young lawyer, played with grim seriousness by an excellent Alexander Kuznetsov, is appalled by the prisoner's tale of woe and obvious injuries. But everyone else he meets during his visit to the jail and throughout his subsequent trip to Moscow to petition the chief Soviet prosecutor seems mildly bemused or hostile to his mission. Two Prosecutors is an exceptionally well-acted and expertly staged political thriller from Loznitsa, marking a return to fictional filmmaking after some recent documentary projects, including the acclaimed State Funeral, released in 2021, about the death of Stalin. Shot in a series of static frames, the opening section is like a slow descent into hell via a series of bland prison offices, grubby hallways and metal gates. But even as the story expands beyond these walls, inside a crowded train to Moscow or in the pristine, almost glamorous, marble-clad corridors of Soviet power, a feeling of paranoia hangs in the air, like a contagious disease or incense in a church. Sergei Loznitsa is coming up.
Advocate, procureur, за местами заключения в Брянске.
Запорет. Вас содержится арестованный Степняк Иван Степанович.
Спецкорпус.
Давай помаринуем его немного.
Говорить при посторонних я не буду.
Sergei Loznitsa, this is a very disturbing film in some ways. It's a beautifully made film, but very disturbing. And for me, I came away from it with this very nightmarish vision of an idealistic man and a courageous man who comes up against a system of sort of cowardly system, really, and a cynical system. And it's about the defeat of his ideals. And I found that very, very troubling.
Yeah, but you know, all film exists in the head of spectators. And all these films are different because different receiving and different thoughts and different people. Yes, I can agree with you on it, but with a small remarks that my hero is not idealist. He just didn't know circumstances of this time and he didn't know circumstances of this kind of life when he did, and this country and this system. He don't know how it functioned. He have a lack of knowledge about this situation where he lived. And I can say that another, like, example, Idiot by Dostoevsky. Person came from Switzerland to Russia and tried to organize life around him in a proper way, how he thought that it will be human and normal. So, he looks like an idiot because he didn't understand how people live there in this country. And this kind of person exists inside all of us. Because we, time from time, we don't know circumstances around us and we don't have enough information. And we always believe to something. You believe that justice exists. This is, we share this kind of idea all. We all believe that justice exists, yes? Democracy work, and good people always win, bad people always lose. this kind of fairy tale.
And he's mistaken.
His job. Yeah, mistaken, but this is often happened with all of us.
Do you think also this kind of thing is starting to happen even in places where we don't consider them to be totalitarian countries?
Yes, of course. Everywhere where exists bureaucracy, it's possible to create more or less the same system.
I mean, there were millions of victims of this terror and of Stalinism, and yet you've made a film, I think, that is very eloquent about this time by focusing, it's quite a miniature film, it's focusing on one particular man in particular who comes up against the system. And it's this amazing performance from Alexander Kuznetsov, who embodies everything of the youthful idealism of this character and a seriousness and a sobriety. And yet there's a naivety, I suppose. How did you find him?
He's a good actor. He was a rising star in Russia. He left Russia in 2022 and 4 or 5 films was not released because he left Russia with his statement against this Russian aggression and etc. And I met him in Cannes and I have seen films with him and met him in Cannes and we became friends and I have no doubt to invite him. Because he's very, very camera love him and he is a very charismatic person.
The camera does love him. He has this striking profile, obviously. It looks like he's had it's almost like a boxer's nose. It seems to be a broken nose. There's a sobriety to him in this film, in the way you've directed him. And
yeah. He's a fantastic actor, that's all. And I just turn him left, right, but it is a touch up, I can say.
This is a film of enclosed spaces, prison offices, corridors, prison cells, train cabins, bureaucratic offices. Some of these spaces, especially when he arrives to the seat of power, are actually quite pleasant and even luxurious, but they always feel claustrophobic. And I notice you don't move the camera in the film, really. Tell me about your approach, stylistically, tonally, to this, to these themes.
Yeah, all my approach came for every film from concept, idea, and looking with the cameraman, with the set designer, and with the other artists with whom I work, and with actors, way how express this idea in best way, and what kind of element of cinema language use for that. And I decide not to move camera because this is prison. Prison is stop in a life of the somebody who arrested and keep it here and sit it there. I don't need to move camera. And also this aspect ratio, which is called academic aspect, also create this tension.
Yes, it's a it's a squarish kind of
1.37.
Yep. Yeah.
Also, other element, like we reduce all this color from picture, which we connect with life, like yellow, green, blue, purple, and etc. But all dress and all decoration and everything what your camera can see, only gray, brown, black, and a little bit dirty white. Also, cameraman, he made a special filter for that.
Ah, really?
To reduce color. Yeah, reduce extra color. And yeah, and with sound also, we carefully worked to create this sound inside the prison. Yeah, all those was used for making this, to create this feeling for spectators that they are in with our hero. This kind of immersive cinema, what I would like invite. I would like invite not to be like observer, but to feel fear, how everybody felt in this film.
There's something particularly heroic, and there's an ironic tragedy in this character as well, because he's not just someone who falls almost innocently as a victim, or not innocently, but who's unaware and sort of becomes this victim. He is also someone who believes in the principles stated by the revolution and the party at this. And so there's an extra layer of sort of irony here, and very tragic irony, that he is such an idealist.
Yeah, but we all such idealists. We also believe in such a principle, and we can change this world, not socialistic, but democratic. We believe in this principle, and we are so naive to do that.
Are you saying we contemporary people living in the world today, or we...
We contemporary people living in world today, yes, yes, yes. We believe, for example, we all European believe in NATO, that NATO protect us from aggression, now from Russian aggression. But in fact, the Russian plane can be in this under NATO country 12 minutes and nothing happened, and drone came. And now I stay in Vilnius, and the airport time from time closed already 4 times because a balloon from Belarus with contraband with cigarette
is flying over the airspace there. Over.
Yes, and nobody can do anything, you know. This is also I can count that as a diversion. Yes, it is a diversion because never happened before. Never before somebody used this kind of balloon which destroyed this plane traffic. Yes, And the same happened a few days ago in Berlin. Some people sent a drone on the Berlin Brandenburg airport. And we cannot do anything, you know.
Well, it's quite a bleak observation. And I want to draw you on the other actors in the film. I mean, it strikes me that the acting, all of the actors almost, are good at presenting two faces. So much of this film is about an exercise in showing the official version and the version behind the official version. And especially, for example, in a top Bolshevik administrator, his crisp way of speaking, the soft but precise diction, his wonderful suit, the office. And at first, I don't want to spoil anything, but you can't tell if he's an ally or not or whatever. But everyone in the film seems to have this duality, except for the protagonist in a way. And did you go looking for actors who are capable of having this duality, this ability to appear convivial, friendly, but also malign?
Actor, you mean Anatoly Bely, who played role Vyshinsky, the main prosecutor. Yes, he also played people from a recent Russian bureaucracy, or maybe people from recent anywhere bureaucracy, more or less, because they all have something in common.
And that's
nothing personal, just a business.
And it's not personal, it's just business.
Also,
yeah.
These old people thinking not about destiny of somebody. They thinking about power and their position, how to save position, how to be there. And this in this episode, the first question for main prosecutor was, okay, who is this strange guy who would like to meet me with a very strange topic that some diversion happened in secret services, let's say, in NKVD. Who is this strange guy? Provocator? Or maybe, I don't know, naive young prosecutor? And this why he just allowed to young prosecutor even speak with him because of fear. Because maybe somebody check him. Stalin check him. He's right.
Yes, prosecutor, maybe this is a test. Wrong. This is a test. Perhaps he's thinking it's a test.
Yeah.
Well, everyone
course.
Everyone in this era, in Stalinism, seems to be extremely... has a very paranoid dimension to their psyche. They have to be paranoid.
Well, not only in Stalinism, you know. I can say the schizophrenia I observe all my life, schizophrenia of the people who occupied this kind of position and fight for money and for power.
Your actors are people who have come from the various former Soviet countries, Russian-speaking actors. What was that like on set? I mean, everyone shares, I suppose, an experience of having roots in this time and in this geographical area.
Yeah. First of all, I work with very good actors. They all very good. I don't have to explain a lot because all people familiar with that. Unfortunately, but it is somehow in our blood.
Filmmaker Sergei Loznitsa. If you know your history, you won't be surprised by where the story of two prosecutors ends up, but you will be enthralled by how the film goes about its business. And what I particularly liked about this film is the way it leaves open certain possibilities about how characters might have acted differently and how we as viewers might bring our own interpretations to certain motivations. Two Prosecutors. It's out in cinemas at the moment. Go see it. And that is it for another episode of The Screen Show. I'm Jason DeRosso. It's been great to have your company. Thanks as always to producer Sarah Corbett and to ABC Radio National's editor of arts, Rhiannon Brown. Until next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.